Session number 21613, room 7.
This is the fourth reel of a taped interview with Peter David Coburn Salmon in his home in Perth, Western Australia, on the 27th of the 3rd, 2001, for the Imperial War Museum in London, and the interviewer is John Bannister. Peter, we were talking about the British soldiers.
Yes.
I was wondering what sort of bond developed between the various soldiers that were fighting in North Africa.
Oh, well, I think there really was a very strong bond, certainly in the Tobruk campaign with us, because we operated very closely with the Royal Horse Artillery, and I think, as I mentioned in an earlier tape, we had a great deal of admiration for them.
But for the average soldier?
Well, I think the average soldier, of course, a lot of Australians have always have called the British soldiers "poms." But it's in many cases an affectionate term. I think we generally had an admiration for each other. Really, I think there was never any bad feeling between the ourselves and the British soldiers. Far from it. You know, it was very cooperative operations.
You mentioned that there were other nationalities in Tobruk as well.
Yes.
You mentioned the South Africans. What was the feeling for the South Africans, especially after Tobruk having fallen?
Well, the only contact I had with the South Africans was when I came back to at Alamein to the first aid post. A lot of the South Africans were operating as stretcher bearers. I have a feeling that they were probably belonged to not exactly conscientious objectors, but they were people who didn't want to, because of their religion or something, did not want to act. I may have been wrong there, but they were very grim people. I thought they were very fine looking fellows, obviously mostly Boers. But they were a bit grim, and not, at that stage, particularly friendly, I felt. But that was really the only contact I had, personally, with the South Africans at all. And that was only one particular unit of them. I mean, what the infantry units were like might have been quite different. But I did have that feeling as seeing them operate. They didn't give a very friendly appearance.
You mentioned that you were in hospital,
mm-hmm.
recovering from a wound. Was this a fairly restful period for you? Was there any recreation involved in the recovery?
No recreation whatever, no. And it was quite a sort of stressful time, really, because when we were in the Australian hospital on the canal, we were in a surgical ward, and of course in those days they didn't have all the techniques that they've got today, and those of us that were able to walk usually vacated the wards when the more badly wounded were being dressed, because it was a pretty unpleasant business, and certainly there was no recreation. But they looked after us very well, really.
When were you told then that you were about to be sent out again?
Oh, well, as soon as I was, you know, well enough and able to walk, we were, of course, sent to Palestine, to recreational camp on the sea.
And what did that entail?
Oh, that was just plenty of rest, a little bit of leave, lots of swimming. And generally just relaxation until you know, got on your feet again, because most of us needed to build up our physical abilities again, because we got a bit run down. But you didn't really know it when you were actually in the line, because it was just something that was there. But once you relaxed, like a lot of other things, it really hits you a bit. But it was a pleasant time in Palestine.
What was it like to finally have that opportunity to relax and be swimming in the Mediterranean?
Pretty good. Yeah, very good. And they were all fellows who were there for to recuperate. We had a pretty good time together. And we had some recreation there. We had volleyball and things like that we used to play as we got better. It was quite a rhetoric.
What did you talk about?
Oh, I suppose we talked more about home and what we were actually doing at the time than we did about anything else. You know, I think we probably put what had happened a bit behind us. Those there had come from all different areas of the front. And but we didn't talk very much about actually what we'd done. Very little.
Was there a degree of avoiding the reality?
I think probably, yes. You know, I should think so, yeah. People just didn't particularly want to talk about it. Just wanted to talk about more mundane things, like letters from home and when we might get home.
Did anyone have any idea about that?
No, they didn't. No, we had no idea that we were going home at that stage. None of us knew. And I don't know whether that it had happened at that stage where Curtin had told Churchill that he wanted to bring the Australians back to defend Australia. We didn't know, and I'm not sure exactly whether that would have happened before Alamein or later. I'm not sure about that.
So the Japanese had obviously been making forays into the northern part of Australia.
Yes, well, also things were looking rather grim around Australia, and I suppose the Australian government felt that that Australia was the priority for us. We couldn't leave it all to American. We had to show that we were doing our bit to defend Australia.
As far as you knew, you were in North Africa to stay.
As far as we knew, yes. We didn't know how long we were going to be there. And we'd been given no hint that we were going home. In fact, for security reasons, I wouldn't think that would have happened anyhow, because it would have involved advising the enemy that there was a convoy coming at some stage. You know, I think all those sort of things would come into it. No, ordinary troops like ourselves wouldn't know a thing.
So you wouldn't have known what was going on in the situation around Alamein?
No, not while we were in Palestine, we wouldn't know. We were just hoping to get back to our units, because we sort of like, our units were really like home, and we all wanted to go back to our own units. But you never quite knew where you were going to get posted, of course, in those sort of circumstances.
Have people been talking about the change in command at all?
No.
Alexander and Montgomery were now in charge?
Yeah, not that I can remember, no. And, no, I can't remember them talking about that, no.
Do you recall getting to know that you were about to be sent back to the front? When did that come about?
Well, I'm not quite sure what the date was. I can't just remember, but as soon as the doctors, you know, felt that you were right, you then went back to staging camp, and we were sent then back to our units.
What was the staging camp like?
Oh, it was just, we weren't there for very long, just a day or two. And then on a train we went to the sewers. Yes, I'm sure it was, by train. Because I do remember, of course, which I haven't mentioned before, we did have a visit in the desert with Churchill, of course, and he came out, and I can remember standing on the road and seeing him go past.
What was that feeling like?
It was very good. Because you really felt that, you know, that the powers that be were taking a real interest in you. And it was a good feeling. But it was a good feeling to get back to the unit too, such as was left, which was not very many.
You mentioned you saw Churchill drive past. Mm. Was this before your involvement with the Alamein situation in July?
Yes, this was before the big battle.
Before the big battle, yes. But after you'd been wounded.
Yes, after, yeah.
And he didn't speak, as far as you knew, at that time. He was just driving past.
Yeah, this was with the... I think at that time he had Moorshead with him, if I remember. I'm sure he did, yes, Moorshead.
What was the feeling amongst the troops towards those two driving by?
Oh, it was a great lift to them, I think. Big lift. Somebody like Churchill came out, it really meant that we were doing something.
What sort of impression of a man did he give the troops, do you think?
Oh, I think he always gave a very confident, He had that bit of what little we saw, but he always looked very confident. Now, he was an amazing man, Churchill. He seemed to have that ability to give people confidence. But we were just troops and not actually taking part in much of what was happening then.
If you'd had the opportunity to speak to him, what sort of things would you have said at the time?
Now, that's a really difficult one. Probably, when are we going home? No, I think that would probably be on all our lips, when are we going home? Yeah.
Okay, so you were to be sent to the big battle of Alamein, and as I understand, this was when Montgomery was making his offensive.
Yes, well, that's right. Because as we knew afterwards, he was determined not to do anything until he had his forces really built up to massive strength. He wasn't going to go off half cocked. He was going to definitely make it make sure that we were really strong. And of course, when the battle started, the artillery barrage was amazing. I think it was about 1,000 guns. A lot of huge barrage.
There had been, as I understand, a bit of a lull while both sides had built up their forces.
There was, yes. Yeah.
Did anyone at that point know the extent of Rommel's defences?
No, we didn't. But whether the High Command did or not, I don't know. But we certainly didn't as troops, no.
As I understand, Montgomery had come in and so had Alexander. What were the... You mentioned that you were given confidence by Churchill, and you mentioned earlier on a little bit about Montgomery, but what was the general feeling of confidence that both of those commanders gave?
Well, I think the officers definitely got a feeling of confidence in Montgomery, and of course Moorshead the troops had an enormous respect for Moorshead. Now, I think everybody was very confident. Nobody ever. I don't think any of us ever thought for a minute that we were going to lose.
So tell us about the opening of the offensive. You mentioned 1,000 guns.
Mm.
What was that like, seeing them start firing up?
Well, we just then knew it was sort of time to go. I really can't recall exactly how I felt at that time, but we realised it was going to be a really big battle, but we as troops really didn't know to how long we were going to be in it. We didn't know that we were going to be stopped once the Germans started to move. we didn't know that. And perhaps it's probably that would be for security reasons that we didn't know, but perhaps if we would have had known, it would have been a bit of a morale booster. But we did not know that we were going home after Alamein. And although the Germans were very outnumbered at the Battle of Alamein, there were times when things got a little bit dicey. But I think our intelligence people did a very good job in as we found it afterwards, in tricking the Germans, tricking Rommel. And I think that had a big bearing on the battle. Because he sent tanks into the wrong spot on stage, into soft sand instead of hard sand, simply because they managed to get maps to him. Mm. I think I told you the story about that, didn't I? Yeah. Mm.
So you were talking about the impressive artillery fire. This was at night time, I understand.
Yes.
What brief had you been given before the battle, before the attack?
Well, we were just told that we were going to move forward, that's all, really. And then that's exactly what we did. I can remember going, one of my most unpleasant experiences, I think, was going forward and I had to jump into an already dug slit trench that was forward of us, and I landed fair and square right onto a corpse that had been there for a very long time. So I had a very long time putting up with a very unpleasant, as you can imagine, odour coming from me. But little things like that stick in your mind. It was dark, and you couldn't see what was in the trench, and I just hopped down into it onto some. I don't even know whether it's German or one of our people, but I think it possibly was one of ours. But those sort of things stick in your memory. But
what's it like to have to move forward at night time, not knowing whether you might put your foot on a mine? Or
I think that is the big worry at night, is you do worry about mines. And you do worry about, for some reason or other, that you aren't able to make the objective that you're going for, that you may have to divert and then possibly get into somewhere where mines haven't been cleared. That's always in the back of your mind. But the sappers did a very good job, and generally, I never envied them their job, clearing mines. But minefields probably were quite a big worry to you. I think all of us had that in the back of our minds, because we'd had instances where we lost chaps on mines. But just to get it all over was in everybody's mind, I think.
What about being in a situation where you're not quite sure who the enemy is in a dark night attack?
Well, I mean, normally you do know, because you're moving on a concerted front, and it's very unlikely, particularly in the early stages of the battle, that you're going to get in front of you your own people. Of course, if it's just a lull time, you've got a password, of course, so anybody comes and you just expect to get the password. Which has changed, of course, frequently. Every night has changed.
You mentioned that there was this barrage. Was it a creeping barrage in front of you?
Creeping barrage, yeah. Yeah.
What's the feeling?
Fairly well ahead of us.
What's the feeling knowing that there is this barrage?
Oh, well, it gives you a lot of confidence, of course. What they were laying down was obviously going to have a very big effect on the enemy. But
what could you see in front of you?
Not much. Practically nothing.
As far as the barrier.
Well, you could just see all the you could just see the light, the explosions and the lighting in the sky, but not much else. Because it was fairly the barrage itself was fairly well ahead of us. It wasn't something that was close.
What are the sounds that you hear?
Oh, lots of noise. This was quite a spectacular show. And but night time is not the best. Of course, the desert has no landmarks you can pick up. But it's all done on distance, you know, the whole thing's worked out. You know exactly how far you've gone. And everybody's got a concerted move forward, right along the line, it's all planned out, so it's just a matter of keeping going till you strike the enemy.
How long was it before the enemy started to open up?
Oh, well, they really didn't. Well, their artillery started to open up, of course. But, it was quite a while before we actually came into contact with machine gun fire and mortar fire, as I remember it. Mm. But
machine guns, as I understand, have been a bit of a terror in the First World War.
Mm.
Did they have that same sort of impact?
Well, you see, they used to have them. A lot of the defences, they had the all coordinated. The machine guns were set up to give a crossfire, and they were all quite coordinated. And the Germans were particularly good at that. We used to have their Spando set up, and the crossfire was pretty horrific. And of course they had their 88 millimetres, which were nasty. But everything was done pretty. I think at the final Battle of Alamein, it mostly, as far as we Australians were concerned, went off very well. You know, mostly all pretty successful. We didn't have any, not where I was anyhow, we didn't have any hiccups at all.
What's it like having a mortar shell that you can hear coming towards you?
Well, often you don't hear much until it actually bursts. And you certainly, in many cases, don't hear the 88mm shells before they burst. Particularly if there's other noise going on, you can't hear the firing when they fire, and of course next thing you know it bursts, and they burst just sort of above your head and shower all the shrapnel down. So even if you're in a slit trench, it can get you. But no.
Do you hear the one that actually gets you? You mentioned when you were wounded.
Normally not. No, you don't. No, you don't often hear it. No, you don't really hear it. No, you probably do an ordinary shell coming. You can sort of hear it whistle. No. But the 88 millimetres, you didn't really hear much of them until they actually exploded. But I can remember one instance in Tobruk where, I don't quite know where it came from, but we had a very big a naval shell came and landed, and that's very nasty. Huge explosion from those. But we never really found out where it came from. Because it certainly wouldn't have been ours. Well, I can't imagine it would have been the enemy's. Whether it was a big gun behind the German lines or not, I don't know. Possibly it was. But it was a very heavy gun fired. But there weren't a lot of those at Alamein, of course.
You mentioned that it was also an airstrike as well, as I understand, along with the artillery. Am I right?
From us, our point of view, oh yes, I'm sure that was happening, yes. Yeah. And of course, the Germans struck too with air at Alamein, dive bombers, and well, yes, I can vividly remember one case of when we were sort of lying low, a little bit behind the lines, and we were dive-bombed by Stukas. And I think that's the nightmare I sometimes still get. It's funny that something like that is something that sticks. That shrieking siren as they came down, nasty. But no, there was, we had our own air power, thank goodness, at Alamein. Quite different to Tobruk. In fact, some of my friends were in the Air Force in North Africa. And I always give them a bit of the round of the kitchen because they weren't at Tobruk.
Did you, you mentioned that, that the troops don't really ever know what's going on.
No.
Were you to learn what you were supposed to be doing?
Yes, well, you see, you really, I mean, in a company, you've got a company commander, and you've got platoon commanders, and you've got section commanders, and really, you only just, and really, that you really just know what your company and your platoons have got to accomplish. You know. That's enough for you to really know, and you just concentrate on your own area given to you.
As I understand, correct me, please. The Australians were to hold the road near the coast.
Yes. Yes, and I think it mainly was to allow the tanks to. I think then the tanks went into tank battle, and our job was just to really hold the, to drive the Germans back from their area and hold it. And as soon as the main movement started, we sort of came to a standstill.
I understand that the one of the objectives was to get to his supply line, and because of the success of the Australians to punch this hole in his defence, he was quite concerned and concentrated heavily on your position.
He did, yes. The Australians took a lot of the flak actually in that part of the battle, and then once, of course, the whole line started to move from the rest of the division and of the divisions involved at Alamein, it was a matter of chasing the Germans and trying to cut them off and do as much damage as possible before they got back and moved their troops too far back to towards Benghazi. But we weren't involved in any of that. We only learnt about that afterwards.
So after your initial attack, you would have basically sit put, were you?
Well, more or less, yes. When the Australian front came to a stop, we more or less just stayed in a holding position.
How long did it take to reach that position?
Honestly, I can't just remember. I can't just remember exactly how long. It's gone, it's so long ago, I can't just remember exactly how many days it was.
The opening offensive, as I understand, was to be on the 23rd of October.
Yes.
And the 1st of November, after a week, things were beginning to turn.
Yeah.
What did it feel like then to have this advance and feel that the Germans retreat?
Well, I don't think we as Australians at that stage really knew that the Germans were moving, were in retreat. We were just still there, just doing our job, and we didn't know what was going on the rest of the front. We didn't know that the whole battle had been a success.